My name's Tiffany Schlein, and I run a film studio in San Francisco, and I founded the Webby Awards, and I am a writer. And could you each introduce yourselves?
Sure. I'm Tracy Atkinson. I'm an executive vice president at State Street. I've been in finance, risk, and compliance positions really my entire career. I'm also on the board of Raytheon Corporation and chair of their audit committee. And I am a mother of two grown children.
Nice.
And I'm still married.
I'm Jessica Donahue, also an executive vice president at State Street. I'm currently a client executive, so I'm in kind of focused on some of our top clients, as well as some of the service teams around performance, compliance, financial reporting. So I've been at State Street quite a while as well, but have twins who are now 16, wow. Both with permits. So, you know, be careful on the roads.
I have to do a shout out. My 16-year-old just got her driver's license today. So woo, she's with my husband. I wish I was there, but yes, raising the next generation. So in the film, which we'll see shortly, and I know we talked about on the phone in the prep, was just the role of mentorship. And my mother got her PhD, and her thesis, her dissertation was on successful women and their mentors. And back then, I mean, this was in the 70s when she was writing it, all of the mentorship studies were about men, of course. Usually all the studies are, until the women come in. But can you each talk about the role of mentorship in your lives and with your work?
Sure, I'll start. So mentorship has been very important to me personally. I've had both male and female mentors throughout my entire career. I think some of the mentors that I had early on in my career, females in particular, were really important, I think, in helping shape me and my what I thought that I could do. And I very much feel like I wouldn't be in the position that I am today, at least professionally, if it wasn't for those mentor relationships. One that I recall in particular was a woman who was I was a young staff person at Pricewaterhouse years and years ago, there was a woman partner there, and she was the first woman to work part time while she was having her children. This is how old I am, Tiffany. She wore pants to the office, and we were like, "Wow, can we wear pants?" She really encouraged me. She was the first person who said to me, "Well, when your partner." You know, you'll do X, Y, and Z. And I was like, wow, she thinks
confident.
I could be a partner, right? And I remember coming home and telling my husband that, like, hey, I think I'm going to be a partner. And I hadn't joined the 401k for the first 5 years I was there because I was convinced I was going to leave the next year. And I joined the 401k, and I ultimately made partner in 11 years. I worked part-time 3 of those years. I was there for 16 years, and I had a terrific career. So I think about that mentorship that I had from her, because she reminded me of me. She was a person who had children, and kind of lived a life outside of work as well. And for me, when I think I saw, you'll see in this film that Tiffany talks about raising up others, and I love that concept. And it's so positive. And this raising up others, I do think, is saying, what did I get from my mentorship, and how do I make sure I'm giving that back? And for me, that is around being very approachable, being very genuine, and telling my story, which is being a mother of two children, one of which has severe special needs, and that the difference that that is in, it brings in your life when you have that experience. And then it just helps others see that these things are not insurmountable. It doesn't mean that you can't have a career and that you can't still be a great mom. And so really kind of sharing those stories so that people it instills in them an ability to see something in themselves that maybe they wouldn't have seen otherwise.
Yeah, a couple things I just wanted to say on that is I think we view mentorship that you have to be a certain age before you can mentor, but I even tell my 10-year-old, I have a 10-year-old and a 16-year-old, that my 10-year-old can be a mentor to a kindergartner. And everyone in this room has some experience and wisdom that they can be sharing. Even younger people can be sharing older people's stuff with tech. You know, you can mentor up and you can mentor down and you can peer mentor. I mean, what would I do without my girlfriends? And I think we need to expand that term of mentorship so it's not like here the wisdom goes down there, but there's so much different kind of wisdom that we can all be mentoring. And then suddenly the world feels incredibly abundant. If you think of mentorship that way, it's like mentors are everywhere. And then one other thing I'd say is when you're negotiating, go to your male mentors, sadly, but true, because they will tell you to ask for a lot more money. And that's something we all need to work on collectively. But I have found whenever I was in a big negotiating moment, I asked my women mentors and I also asked my male mentors, and they always push me to squeeze my toes in my boots as I asked for the bigger number.
Now, and I'd say my experience with mentors was maybe a little bit different because I didn't have a lot of mentors or people who maybe looked or acted like I thought of myself as, you know, looking at and acting in my, you know, from the leadership perspective or just being around women who were on the same career path. I did my PhD in economics. There were almost no women, and the women who were professors were really not something that I wanted to emulate. And then went to State Street and was working on the sales side. Again, very few women. So I didn't see a lot of people who looked like what I wanted to attain. It took me some time to meet people like Tracy, right, and to find mentorship. But Tiffany, your comment about finding mentors in sort of different ways really resonates to me, or with me, because I did find that I had, you know, cheerleaders and mentors, you know, whether it was my grandmothers who kept telling me, you can do anything. And I lost both of them last year. It was very, you know, for me, I knew they were always there. But also, you know, different women and men who at key times in my life said, you can do it. Right. And even though I didn't know exactly where I was going. So but Tracy came into my life, what, about five years ago at a wonderful women's leadership experience. And we had this little small group. There were only four of us, I think, in it with somebody who was facilitating. And I'd really hit a plateau for me in my career. I had some baggage that I just couldn't seem to let go. And it was Tracy who said, get the monkey off your back. You've got to figure out how. And we talked about how. And I'm telling you, it changed everything for me. So Tracy's way up there on my list of mentors.
You know, one thing I'd like to share, if you're looking for a mentor, is I wouldn't recommend out of the blue that you write to someone or approach someone and say, will you be my mentor? Because a mentorship is about a relationship. And even as we're throwing this word out, mentor, all over the place, a lot of my mentors, I don't think I've ever said, you're my mentor. And what younger people, because I actually have had people come up to me after a screening or something, would you mentor me? And I don't know them, and I'm can barely have enough space in my life for the people that I do mentor, or my kids or husband, all of that. But I think it's really about a relationship. And if you reframe it, it's about someone that you respect and that you want to nurture that relationship and keep them posted on your career, and then they will become your mentor. The other thing I would like to say to never say to anyone, because it's a pet peeve of mine, is when people write to me and say, can I pick your brain? And I'm like, ouch! Because I make a lot of films on neuroscience and I write about a lot about neuroscience. I don't want anyone to pick my brain. Just shower me with what you like about my work and then ask what you're looking for and then end it with another compliment. And that's what we call a love sandwich. But when you just write to someone and say, I really want to pick your brain, I just think that's not a good approach when you're looking for advice or mentorship or whatever you want to call it. Those are just my two little notes I wanted to put out there. Hopefully stop that phrase from ever happening.
That and keep your eyes peeled.
Oh, that's a horrible one. Your eyes peeled. Wait, can I say one more? Can I? A ball buster. Why? Why do we have to use that visual? Like, I mean, I like, or somebody says, you know, they got big balls. I like to say I got big ovaries. That's a much better way to phrase all of it. Language, words have power. And when we say these expressions, let's kind of come at it from a more women power positive perspective. Okay, let's go back to what we were talking about. How are we doing on picture over there, gentlemen? Oh, that's not good. Okay. okay, so now you, in your work, in your career, I mean, you know that with progress, they say it's like two steps forward and one step back. And I mean, there's so many points of light that I feel in the world right now. And then there's so many things I'm still frustrated about. But in the film, and what I always like to think about is how much progress we have made. Instead of focusing on, oh, we're only 3% of CEO, we're only this percent of that. Well, 100 years ago, we just got the right to vote. and you could die from a paper cut. Like, there's been progress, and we need to keep that right here with us as we push on forward, and that's, again, coming from the space of abundance instead of scarcity. But in your field, oh my gosh, well, we are going to, what shall we do, ladies? Shall we keep talking? Should we show the
final? I think let's go right into the movie because we've kept them waiting. The anticipation.
Okay. Okay, so we're going to probably go off the stage so we can. Okay. Thank you, everyone. This is an experiment in screenings. Okay. Thank you.
I recently learned this fact that completely blew my mind. I'm at this event and I meet a woman named Laura Liswood, and we're talking. I'm like, what do you do? And she said, I convene elected women presidents and prime ministers for the United Nations. And I was like, wow, that's an amazing thing to do. How long have you been doing that? She said, oh, around 20 years. I was like, how many had there been 20 years ago? And she said, 15. So I was like, well, how many are there today? And she said, oh, around 50. And I was like, 50? How did I not know that there had been around 50 elected women presidents and prime ministers? And that made me think, gosh, maybe we've been just telling the story of scarcity for so long, and maybe it's time we told a new story of abundance. I woke up the next morning and I couldn't wait to tell Ken and our daughters about how many women had been elected heads of state. And then I proceeded to ask everyone around me who I thought might know the number, and nobody even came close to half. I asked friends, I asked CEOs of big companies, feminists, people on the street.
How many elected women presidents and prime ministers in the whole world do you think there have been? Elected, no royalty.
Two or three.
Not many.
Five, six?
Ten? I would say under five.
I don't know.
So the answer is 50.
50, really?
50.
Oh, wow.
50.
Oh, good.
But not enough.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always thought of myself as a feminist. My great-grandmother marched, my mother marched, I've marched. Even when I was growing up, my mom was writing her PhD thesis on the importance of mentors and mothers on successful women. And my dad wrote books about women in power. So I was completely disappointed in myself for not knowing. And it made me think, what else don't I know? And this all set me down a road to piece together a new narrative that looks at, where are we really on the greater arc of history of women in power? And what's it going to take to get to a 50-50 world? And I'm not talking just politics and boardrooms. I am talking across all parts of society, truly shifting the gender balance to be better for everyone. So in order to think about where we are on this arc and how we're going to get to where we want to go, let's go back to the very beginning. It turns out the oldest hominid ever discovered is a female hominid, not a feminist, but a feminid. Okay, we actually know very little about who wore the pants back then. Not that pants even existed. But fast forward to the Neolithic age, things were pretty egalitarian. Women and men had equal social status, and the earliest written laws reflected these egalitarian societies. Women could choose to marry and divorce. Women were healers, shamans, religious leaders, warriors, and lawmakers. All genders were respected. We're talking over 10,000 years ago this was happening. And then, like many times on our journey, the story takes a dark turn. The balance shifted. My father attributed this shift to literacy rewiring our brains. Others point to the rise of agriculture, which favored physical strength, the conquest of land. We started seeing the development of military, political power. Even art became more dude-centric. Goddesses became gods, and the voices of women were silenced. In ancient Mesopotamia, one of the earliest laws stated, if a woman speaks to a man out of turn, her teeth will be smashed in by a burnt brick. Patriarchy had arrived and was literally chiseled in stone. But we know that our history has been written mostly by men.
Mm-hmm.
I want the rest of the story. How are we supposed to know where we are in the arc of history if we don't have the full context?
And not just elected leaders, but the centuries of badass women that I know were there, paving the paths and contributing to where we are today. Let's go find them. Here we have Hatshepsut in ancient Egypt, one of the first great women leaders. Egypt thrived under her long and influential reign for 22 years. But the next pharaoh literally chiseled her face out of history. And here's Boudica, the woman warrior who led the Britons in a revolt against the Romans. And Wuzi Tian, the first and only female ruler of China, who also had her story altered by the men who followed. There was Margaret I of Denmark, who united the Scandinavian nations. I had never seen all these women linked together. Like warrior queen Amina, who ruled what is now Nigeria. And Queen Elizabeth I, at the time the most powerful person in the world, ruled for nearly 50 years. While she was in power, an explorer brought her what he thought was the horn from a unicorn. She liked it so much she added it to the crown jewels. We could actually call her a unicorn. We could call all of these women unicorns. Not mythical or unreal, but women who stood out, unique to their day. Courageous women navigating uncharted terrain. And as I learned more about these women, I kept thinking about my mom's thesis that looked at successful women and the importance of their female mentors. So, Mom, how would you define a mentor?
Someone who helps somebody else find their own path. One question you haven't asked me, which is important, is why did I study mentors? I never had a mentor. And then I thought, I wonder what it's like if someone had a mentor. All the studies, and I had to read all the studies about men first, having a mentor made the difference in the final push toward success.
I mean, how did my mom accomplish so much without a mentor? And how did these women centuries ago accomplish so much? Did they have mentors? How did it even work back then? There was no easy way to connect with other women leaders.
Hello. Hello.
And no narrative over time to link their stories together. But eventually that narrative did begin. Like with Christine de Pizan in France in the 1300s. 500 years before the word feminism was even coined, she is considered the first writer to examine the roles of women throughout history and to weave together their experiences, creating a narrative not just of political leaders, but of women in all different ways we contribute to society. And over the centuries, countless women would build on that narrative as artists, storytellers, philosophers, mothers, and leaders. But the mountains of imbalance were also centuries high, and for everyone climbed, there was another to struggle with. Room for fewer and fewer at the top, with more struggling to climb, more hurdles, more pushback. Like it was around this time that many of the wise, independent, and rebellious women of their day were labeled witches and put on trial. An estimated 50,000 women in Europe and the U.S. were burned and executed. That's a lot of powerful women to lose from our narrative. And the imbalance was also becoming more and more embedded in political structures. Even our own country, which I do love, was established with the line, "All men are created equal." And this was a time of slavery. Clearly, they didn't mean all men. And clearly, they didn't mean women. Women couldn't own property. We had the same legal status as children. We couldn't vote. But no mountain was going to truly hold our power back. Women were rising in art, science, and culture. And pioneers were gathering, coming together to fight for more rights. Momentum was building in Europe, the US, and dots around the globe, into what we now call the first wave of feminism. In 1848, 300 women and a few men convened in Seneca Falls, New York, and declared, "All men and women are created equal." The whole suffragist fight was gruesome, but the battle was worth it. 70 years after Seneca Falls, women in the U.S. won the right to vote.
but I found this part so haunting.
Only one of the women who attended Seneca Falls was still alive.
Charlotte Woodward was 92 and she didn't make it to the polls.
She got sick on election day.
And this story was such a reminder for me on how long real social change takes. And that we can't take any of these hard-fought rights for granted. And if we want to be alive to experience a more equal world, we have to accelerate the pace of change. And I do think that's happening. I mean, if we look at the whole arc of history, a lot has happened in the last 100 years. Even just in my lifetime. I was born in 1970, the heart of the women's movement.
I am woman, here we born.
It was an amazing surge of momentum. The second wave of feminism, which, like all change, had all kinds of challenges.
The national chairman of the movement to stop the so-called Equal Rights Amendment is Mrs. Phyllis Schlafly.
That Equal Rights Amendment, by the way, the ERA, was first introduced in Congress in 1923, was brought back in the 70s and every year after, and it still hasn't passed 100 years later. But what I didn't fully grasp about the momentum in the 70s is that while all the strides and struggles were happening in the U.S., women gathering, creating support groups, fighting for more rights, there was also a lot of exciting things happening on an international scale. By 1970, three countries had elected women as heads of state. And in 1975, the UN brought together the first International Women's Conference. Over 6,000 delegates from 133 countries traveled to Mexico City and gathered in person for 2 weeks to discuss the status of equal rights on a global scale. They made a collective plan. They'd convene again in Copenhagen in 1980.
Above all, we have learned that to achieve full justice and equality for women will require a long and patient struggle.
And they'd meet again in Nairobi in 1985 and Beijing in 95.
Human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights once and for all.
It's like all these decades of global gatherings. We're all the first and onlys, the unicorns from all over the world coming together to build networks of support. Kind of perfect that a herd of unicorns is called a blessing. It was also in the mid-90s that Laura Liswood started the Council of Women Leaders.
I was noticing some very common themes running through about power, about how women are treated. I started asking them if they wanted to meet. They said they did. And so that's how the council started.
And picture, this was the 70s, 80s, and 90s. All the connecting was done with faxes, letters, and plane rides just to have conversations. It's a whole different world today. The internet is accelerating the pace of change in so many ways. We can connect across continents and write and share stories that aren't already there, which brings power and opportunity to far more voices. But along with that comes greater responsibility.
Our work is not done.
Violence against women is global and systematic.
Inequality is still present throughout every facet of our lives.
In addition to that transparency and responsibility, today's world also gives us more ways to learn from each other, person to person and country to country.
I understand one of the priorities for you was to have a cabinet that was gender balanced. Why was that so important to you?
Because it's 2015.
There are over 300 studies showing that making those changes from all levels, business, politics, and culture, makes life better for everyone, not just women, everyone. Over half of the countries that rank highest in gender equality across different sectors also rank highest on the Global Happiness Index. A lot of these countries pay for early childcare and high-quality education, They have national parental leave for both men and women.
So instead of this idea of stay-at-home mom, they're supporting parents, period.
Because dads are being deprived of their power too. The power of nurturing and raising the next generation. A recent study in the U.S. showed that 50% of men who are offered paid paternity leave feel they can't take it. Men have an entire history of stereotypes and expectations to wrestle with too. And those men who are equal parents, I feel like they're the next chapter of first and onlys that are paving the path to something better. 50-50 isn't just about women getting more power. It's about everyone getting more power. It's about opening up the whole idea of what power is. Moving beyond the binaries of men and women, we're all on a continuum with different combinations of strengths to bring to the table. Power is leadership, but power is also love. Power is empathy. Power is the opportunity to find your own path. So how do we really get there to the world we want to see? Turn to the person who blew my mind and set me down this path in the first place. So, Laura, how do we get to 50-50?
Well, I think change itself goes from the unthinkable to the impossible to the inevitable. But someone has to move it along. I often like it to a standing ovation. A few people jump up and say, this is the best thing that they have ever seen. Then another larger group gets up and says, yes, yes, this was just excellent. Then the large group gets up and says, yeah, yeah, this was okay. And then finally the last group gets up because they can't see the stage.
So where are we on that arc of history?
I think the generations that are alive today have the potential to reach that standing ovation.
But although, as we know, change can be very disruptive and very unsettling for people. And often there's some group of people who want to revert to a good old days kind of thing.
But the rest of us, we need to stand up and keep clapping.
In the middle of this journey, our daughter Odessa was getting bat mitzvah. And Ken and I talked so much about what we were each going to say to her at this big rite of passage.
My favorite saying in the Talmud is, when you teach your children, you teach your children's children.
A mentor is someone who helps somebody else find their own path.
These are all the people who are going to be there for the rest of your life supporting you. Each of these people has a whole room of people that supported them to allow them to be in this room supporting you.
Piecing together this history and putting it into context made me see mentorship in a whole new way. Mentors are all around us, younger, older, peer to peer, country to country, and from all of history. And we need to keep them all right here, right next to us. I used to think I had the full context of women in power, but I was still letting the story of scarcity guide me. And then I realized that if we really build on the centuries of momentum, generations of courageous women of all races that have brought us this far, we can take this story of scarcity and turn it into a story of abundance.
When you get to the top of the mountain, pull the next one up. Then there'll be two of you, tired and proud. And when the second one has finished taking in the view, let her pull the next one up. Room enough for all on the mountain peaks to pull the next woman up. The next man up. Pull the next up. 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 Up.
can't wait to update the ending of that movie. I mean, since we updated it after the first time, there's been like another 12 women that get added to that montage sequence. I always start tearing up because that's the kind of power that we should feel that force from. Anyway, that was interesting to talk before about the importance of mentorship. How was that to like talk about it and then see it? Maybe I'll start doing that. We have microphones in the aisles. There's one right there and right there. If anyone wants to come and ask us questions, and while we're waiting for courageous people to do that, I'll ask you two questions. So you have this amazing company that has sponsored this amazing conference. When I heard the name of your company and how much clapping, I thought, did you bring your whole company? That is amazing. And what leadership that shows that you support women. So do you want to talk about some of your thinking at the company to support women and leadership?
Sure. So we have had targets for women in leadership for quite some time, right? And I think really at the forefront of doing that. And we haven't always met them, okay? And I would say that that's something that we continue to really work on through different mentorship and sponsorship programs, through really building metrics and trying to really understand how we're making progress, and then making sure that we have women who are making themselves available, like Tracy, like myself, to be that mentor in those moments, you know, where women do need either, you know, a hand up or, you know, just also need maybe sometimes a shoulder to cry on, right? Because I think we all have our moments where it doesn't always feel like we're seen or like it's fair. And we need to have the abundant mindset, and it's hard to always be there. And so making sure we have each other in a network of people and opportunities to get together is also a big part of it.
Wonderful. I see we have someone right there. You? Yeah?
Hi. My name's Bridget, and I'm from Fresenius Medical Care. And I had a question, because one thing I liked about your film is it was not just about rising women up, but also rising men up too, or all people up. And I'm the mother of like two little boys. So I want to know, like, what can I teach my children, my boys, to help them want to get to a 50-50 world? And also, I also have a question about how can we change society so it's no longer a stay-at-home mom, so it can be a stay-at-home dad? Because I feel like we don't really have many, like, you don't really hear about stay-at-home dads that often in our world.
I have one.
So.
Do you?
Yeah, matter of fact, a lot of women at our level at our company have husbands who chose to stay at home. Mm-hmm. I imported my mother.
My husband stayed home right after I made partner when I was at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and I would tell you all my friends who, you know, a lot of women at our level at State Street, and a lot of my friends who are partners, female partners at PwC's, husbands are stay at home. And those are choices, right? That because you can, you know, it was a panel earlier on, I think, during the lunch keynote, where the woman who was interviewing Megan Rapinoe said, it's all about the money. And a lot of it is about the money, right? Around choices, around, because that's what families do. They need to make choices around who you know, if you need to stay home and care for your children, who's going to do that? And money is a huge driver of that. So, you know, and as to what to teach your boys, I mean, I think the best thing you can teach them is every day what you're role modeling, right?
I
every
agree.
Single day.
Because I my twins are girl-boy twins, so I live in a gender experiment all the time. But it you know, my son is also my advocate, so sharing your frustrations with your boys is a big deal, because they need to see that it's not always easy and to empathize with that. And it makes them, you know, really connect to the women in their lives very differently, too. So I really think sharing your frustrations, as much as that may be hard, and, you know, appropriately, given their age, is important. But watching you go to work and succeed is the best way to show them what the future can be like.
Yeah, and I think I'm in a 50-50, nothing's ever really fit. 1 week it might be 50-50. Next week, my husband's a professor, so he has a flexible schedule, but I've been on book tour for my book, and he's been great, and he had a strong mother and strong sisters, which I really attribute a lot of it to. So anyone still looking for a husband, look for someone that has strong sisters and mothers. That helps. But it is interesting. At the end of the day, though, on book tour, when I look at our joint schedule and I see he has a conference and I've been invited to go somewhere, I will be the one to go. A parent needs to be home, so I won't do that. And but I think it's an ongoing conversation. But, of course, my generation, my mother was amongst a whole bunch of women that felt like they had to get divorced to go out and get their PhD. So I'm almost 50, so I was raised in the 70s. So that was the generation I came from, was all these women that had to break up families, a lot of them, to feel like they could be their true self. So fortunately, I feel so grateful that I am a film director. I didn't think twice about being a film director. And so I really do think the next generation down, they're seeing that, and there's so many evolved husbands and fathers I see. I mean, I see them every day, whether they get the acknowledgement, or maybe they get too much acknowledgement sometimes for being, good fathers when women are doing that all the time. But I do think we are evolving, and that's the big message through all of this, is to always remember how far we have come, even though we have so far to go. Over in the stripe.
Hi.
There.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the film. I'm 50. I've been a feminist before puberty, so it makes me an optimist, I think, by nature. I'm also an attorney, and a good part of my career I've spent advocating for sexual assault survivors and for reproductive rights. And so the lawyer in me sees danger everywhere and wants to mitigate risk. And I feel like we are in a particularly precarious moment in history, and I'm so terrified of what I feel like is a unbelievably growing backlash against any semblance of power that women have gained over the last decade, two decades. And I think one of the things that is important to me is sort of a network of women who support me during that. And I'm wondering how you view, when you look at this arc of history, how you see where we are now and the danger for backlash, particularly in the area of reproductive rights in this country.
Well, funny you should bring that up, because I just directed a 2-minute film on reproductive choice that I was going to show. So can I just show it right now? And it says how I feel.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. It's number 3. I do a lot of work in reproductive choice. And I also, like you, was...
Our bodies are our own.
If they are not, we cannot be truly equal.
Everyone deserves health care.
It's a human right.
We must have the freedom to decide for ourselves whether or when to have children.
This includes access to abortion.
It is not up to politicians,
corporations, college presidents,
insurers, or pharmacists to decide.
Birth control is basic health care.
We all deserve access.
We all deserve to be safe and free from sexual assault,
harassment, and violence.
That means consent.
We deserve economic equality.
Equal pay and equal opportunity are essential
to reach our full potential.
All people deserve healthy and safe pregnancies, births, and paid family leave.
We must support parents.
We reject racism,
sexism, homophobia,
and transphobia.
We all deserve to live our lives freely and safely.
That's how I feel about that. But I think it's very scary right now, and when everyone here that cares about these issues, we have to just be vigilant on protecting the rights that our mothers and grandmothers fought so hard for.
Thank you. I really needed that.
Yeah. And the thing that maybe gives me some hope is it's very hard to meet a teenage boy, a man in his 20s or 30s who doesn't agree. Yeah. Right. So it feels like there's a tipping point somewhere that we won't have to worry about this anymore. Mm. We're still just not there. Mm.
That's a great point. Yeah.
As women who have advanced very far in your careers in spaces that the ratio may not be as supportive yet, and who have strong support for mentoring, do you feel yourself stretched thin while trying to support the women around you? And how can male allies and other people try and fill in those gaps so you don't end up torn or stretched too far?
Thank you for that question. Yeah. You sound like you're an ally, so thank you for that. Showing up today, you certainly are. Jess and I have direct experience. You know, I do feel very stretched at times. In fact, that was part of the coaching that Jen gave me at that Jess gave me at that leadership conference was around, you know, trying to find time for myself and being stretched in a lot of different ways. You know, you do feel a responsibility, and people come up to me all the time and ask me to be the mentor. I've kind of tried to, you know, kind of broaden my reach in terms of doing sessions with, you know, four or five women at a time and, you know, get a topic. And we're doing that with all of our female EVPs, you know, maybe not even having a topic, just opening it up for a dialogue and a chance for women across our organization to interact with us. But we also have specifically invited our male colleagues to join us in this effort and, you know, hand-selected those guys that we thought really got it, and they've been tremendous and really have helped kind of, you know, kind of own this collectively across our organization, so it's been really great.
And I would just say, if you're ever, as a man, or all the women in the room, talk to the men in your life about this, if you're ever asked to speak somewhere or, you know, always recommend a woman, a person of color, just look at who's not at the table. So I feel like my husband, you know, is in robotics where there are not enough women. And he was just telling me, he's like, I just got invited to a speak and every keynote is a white guy. And so he wrote and said, can you look for some women? It might be a little harder, but can I recommend some? So I would just say everyone should just think whenever you're asked to do something, who needs space that doesn't have it and who can you recommend? What I think is a really good thing to do.
Actually, on that same note, women have had such a struggle, and now it's becoming more socially acceptable to have non-binary and transgender folks. How do we make sure they don't get left behind and have to go through this same struggle?
Mm-hmm. My nephew is transgender, and my producer's transgender, so I've actually even made a film called Trans Boom. It's a 7-minute film. So I've thought a lot about this because, you know, even when I made 50-50, we followed it up with 50-50 Day, which is like a global day. The next one's happening on Pay Equity Day this in 2020, which I'd love for you to all be a part of. But he had a problem with the term 50-50 because for a while there, before he identified completely as a man, he was non-binary. And he was like, well, that's putting people as women and men. But of course, I meant it more like the scales, like let's get some balance back. But he really challenged me on that term. And that's one of the reasons why we're attaching 50-50 to Pay Equity Day, because that is so clear where it's about money. Because there's a lot of money. I'm so glad you brought that up earlier. So much of this is about money. But going back to non-binary and trans, I think what we're really talking about is more balanced perspectives in everywhere. So I think, you know, anytime you think, who's not at the table? That's always just a question. Who's not at the table? What voice isn't represented here? And it's exciting because it's been a pretty big year for trans people and non-binary people. So I think you're going to see the pendulum open things up even more. But everyone has to be a voice in making room for people.
Yeah, and one of the things that we're now doing, though it's early stages, is trying to encourage people to proactively talk about their differences. Mm. Okay, and that means self-declaring. And being able to then find populations of advocates within the firms, within our firm. And one of the things we have been talking about is putting in our signatures, and I think proactively putting in our signatures, our pronouns of choice, right? Which should signal to anyone that we are very open to how they want to be referenced, right? And so, although it's taken me time to get used to they as a
singular pronoun. You know that was the word of the year?
They.
The web, you know, they always do like a word of the year for the Webster's Dictionary. That was the word.
They.
Wow. Yeah.
And the other one is nibblings, which is your siblings' kids who don't want to be gender specified.
Oh. I have never heard of that. Yeah. Wait, did you say nibbling?
Nibbling.
Instead of sibling.
Instead of sibling.
Hi, I'm Stacey. Of course, I would say thank you, Tracy and Jess, who personally have mentored me and mentor me, and so that you live every day what you're sharing with us, and I thank you for that. A question for the three of you that was spurred by the afternoon session. Megan Rapinoe was talking about how, in a lot of ways, the structure is really set up to prevent drastic change and that we need to step out of it. And it really got me thinking, as you both know, I've been a prosecutor and trial lawyer, and I had a female mentor say to me, don't you dare ever wear a pantsuit in front of a jury because it's not worth losing a case to stand on your principles. So asking you as mentors, have you ever felt constrained, like telling them how to play the game to win? Or do you feel constrained from telling them to step out at their own personal cost? How do you deal with that?
I mean, I see it as a fine line between what's distracting and what's just being you and being genuine. I feel like, you know, as I told my story, I am very genuine. I am an authentic person, and lots of times I don't fit the mode. My laugh is too loud. I'm, you know, kind of, you know, I want to, you know, engage and get to know people. I don't just come in, and that's the way I work, and it doesn't matter who I'm sitting with. That's the way I'm interacting with people, because I, you know, I want to interact with people. I just don't want to show up and just go through the five things that we need to accomplish, because that's not adding meaning to my life, and it doesn't make for a very fun workplace. So I've always been me, and you know what? I keep telling myself all the time when I think, ugh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. It's just like, hey, you know what? It hasn't hurt me to date. So I just encourage you to make choices that, you know, and not everything. Sometimes you need to rein it in or you need to do something different. But they shouldn't be things that are value inhibitors, right? You know, if you want to wear pants, you should wear pants. But, you know, if you're just as comfortable in a dress, hey, wear the dress. If that, you know, that's the way I look at it. Like, you know, some things matter and some things don't.
Yeah, I'd call it the can you look in the mirror at the end of the day test. If you still feel, you know, good about who you are and who you're showing up as, then you're in good shape, right?
That is our time. I have one more. Oh, I'm sorry. Is that really our time? One more. I don't know who is standing longer. Yeah, okay.
So I have a question for those of us who may face within our own family some maybe supporters but not advocates, if we have a spouse or a parent that maybe kind of encourages us to do our own thing but is not like helping us go out and do it and really not giving us that true encouragement that we need. So I'm wondering if you might have some advice on how to address that in our own family.
Yeah. You know, I'm a big proponent in finding your, I call it an advisory board. So if you don't have it in your own family, build your own advisory board. And that can literally be three or four people you really respect that do support you, that you invite over every quarter for wine and cheese and tell them what you want to do in your life and how can you get there. But sometimes it's not, just like sometimes people don't feel like their own family that they feel like they belong in that. And sometimes you have to find your own advisory board. So I would just say to you, think of a couple people and say, can I invite you over for, you know, a night? And I want to tell you about some things I'd love to do and love to get your advice. People love that. So I think sometimes you do have to go outside. On that note, you've been an incredible audience, and thank you for being so patient with the AV issues. Thank you, and thank you both for being so wonderful and supporting this conference. Thank you.